This episode of The Trail Went Cold is brought to you by Zola. Zola is reinventing the wedding registry and planning process to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. To sign up with Zola and receive a $50 credit towards your registry, visit zola.com/cold and use the promo code COLD at checkout. That's zola.com/cold and the promo code is COLD. This episode is also brought to you by Aptiv. Aptiv produces audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers available through a mobile app. New members get 50% off an annual membership, so please visit aptiv.com/cold. That's aptiv.com/cold. Thank you, and enjoy the show. April 20th, 1989. Circle, Montana. While driving on the wrong side of a rural highway, 37-year-old Patricia Meehan gets into a collision with another car. After staring blankly at the other vehicle's driver, Patricia walks out onto the prairie and disappears. During the next few months, there would be numerous sightings of a disoriented woman resembling Patricia, leading to speculation that the trauma of the car crash caused her to develop amnesia and forget who she was. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to 2017's final episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and to close out the year, I'm going to do something special by covering not one, but two cases which were featured on Unsolved Mysteries: the 1989 disappearance of Patricia Meehan, and the 1985 murder of Morris Davis. Both of these cases took place in Montana and are very memorable, but since there isn't a whole lot to talk about in regards to either of them, I thought it would be a wise idea to combine them together into one episode. Now, say what you will about 2017 overall, but I think we can unanimously agree that one of the biggest highlights of this past year was the resurrection of Unsolved Mysteries. For the longest time, we could not view classic episodes of the show anywhere on the internet, but after its digital distribution rights were acquired by a company called FilmRise, they started releasing entire seasons on Amazon Prime this past January. At this very moment, every single season of Unsolved Mysteries is currently available for viewing, which is something I never would have envisioned over a year ago. But even though you can now watch so many classic episodes, there is still a major demand for me to cover Unsolved Mysteries cases on The Trail Went Cold, so I think it only appropriate that I close out 2017 with a double feature. I've selected the Patricia Meehan disappearance because it was a case requested by our latest Trail Went Cold contest winner, Andrew Dodge, who will be reciting the opening narration on a future episode to be released in January. I've also decided to cover the murder of Morris Davis, not only because of the Montana connection, but it is one of those pesky Unsolved Mystery segments which did not get uploaded to Amazon Prime, and I don't really understand that decision since the case has still never been solved. Anyway, I'll start off by sharing Patricia's story and providing my analysis about it before we move on to Morris's case. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or a review to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us start off by exploring the unsolved disappearance of Patricia Meehan.
Thank you.
Our story begins in Montana in 1989. Our central figure is 37-year-old Patricia Meehan, who originally hails from Pittsburgh, but now lives in Bozeman, and is employed as a ranch hand who works with horses. However, Patricia has become noticeably depressed and withdrawn. Even though she loves children, and initially planned to have a career in daycare, Patricia seems saddened by the fact that she is reaching the age where it may soon be too late for her to have children of her own. On April 19th, Patricia called her parents to tell them she was under great stress and inquired about the possibility of moving back home to Pittsburgh to live with them for a while. Her parents agreed to the idea, and Patricia scheduled an appointment with her psychologist for the morning of April 21st in order to discuss this idea. Patricia did not like to fly, but her parents did not like the idea of her driving over 1,800 miles to Pittsburgh, but they agreed to talk about it after her appointment. On April 20th, Patricia called her landlord to say she would be gone for a while before leaving her apartment in Bozeman, and he would later describe her as sounding very hyper and not making much sense. At around 8:15 p.m. that evening, Patricia was driving east down Highway 200 in a desolate rural area 7 miles southwest of the small town of Circle. This location was nearly 400 miles away from Bozeman, and Patricia was inexplicably driving on the wrong side of the road when another car approached. Patricia nearly wound up having a head-on collision with this car, which swerved out of the way. However, there was another car behind that one, and even though the driver tried to pull off the road, Patricia still wound up crashing into her. The driver was left dazed, but not seriously injured, though she would end up witnessing a strange sight after she exited her vehicle. Patricia emerged from her own car and walked towards the wreckage, where she proceeded to stare down at the driver. She was described as having a blank look in her eyes and gave off no reaction to the situation at all. Without saying a word, Patricia walked away from the road, climbed over a fence, and stared aimlessly at the accident scene again. She then walked onto the open prairie and subsequently disappeared into the night. When police were notified and arrived at the scene, they searched Patricia's car, and there were clothes and other items in the vehicle which suggested she was in the midst of taking a trip somewhere. The only item Patricia would have had on her when she left the scene was her purse. The police searched the prairie, and about 3/4 of a mile from the crash scene, they were able to find a trail of size 6 tennis shoe tracks which probably belonged to Patricia, but these tracks soon came to an end. For the next 5 days, an extensive ground and air search was conducted of the area, but other than her shoe tracks, no trace of Patricia could be found. It was established that a hay truck had been parked about a half mile away from the accident scene before it was driven away, so it was theorized that Patricia might have stowed away on the truck without the driver's knowledge, or that she was picked up after hitching a ride somewhere. Anyway, when Patricia's family was contacted, they had no idea why she was driving nearly 400 miles away from Bozeman, as she gave off the impression that she would not be traveling to Pittsburgh to see them until after her appointment with her psychologist the following day. Regardless, Patricia's parents and brother would spend the next few months traveling around the Pacific Northwest in order to distribute over 2,000 missing persons flyers, and it wasn't long before reported sightings of Patricia started popping up all over the place. Many of the alleged sightings of Patricia took place at truck stops in Montana or Washington State, but it seemed like whenever the authorities or her family were notified, she would hitchhike out of the area before they could arrive at the scene. But the most consistent detail from these sightings was that Patricia looked confused and disoriented. Initially, it was suspected that she might have fled the scene of the accident to avoid potential legal trouble, but the accounts of the sightings of her told a different story. For example, on May 4th, 2 weeks after the accident, a police officer believed he saw a woman resembling Patricia at a Hardee's restaurant in Laverne, Minnesota, where she reportedly sat in a booth drinking water for 5 straight hours until the restaurant closed. Afterward, the woman then walked to a nearby 24-hour diner, and when the officer approached her and tried to question her, she would not give her name, though she did claim she was from Colorado, before then saying she was from Israel. The following day, she was seen at a truck stop at Sioux Falls, South Dakota, drinking coffee and laughing at herself. A female truck driver crossed paths with her in the restroom, staring at herself in the mirror, and when she asked the woman her name, she replied, "I don't know." Later that night, Patricia was spotted at another truck stop over 200 miles away in the town of Murdo, but this time, she was arguing with a male companion. The most interesting sighting occurred on May 19th, when Patricia was seen by two waitresses at a Perkins restaurant in Bozeman, only a few miles from where she lived. She came in at around 8:30 a.m. to order coffee and a cinnamon roll, and told the waitress she was in a hurry because she needed to go shopping. But then she remained in the restaurant for around 2 hours and spent most of the time either talking to herself or just staring blankly. When she left, she paid the $2 tab entirely in change. In addition to circulating her photograph, Patricia's family also brought a videotape of her with them to show to people who had seen her. When the waitresses in Bozeman watched this tape, they were very certain the woman they'd seen was Patricia. The sightings would continue for over a year, and an interesting development occurred in August of 1990, when a transient woman with a strong resemblance to Patricia was arrested for littering in Idaho. It was initially suspected she might be Patricia, but a fingerprint check confirmed this was not her. But if some of these sightings were accurate, and Patricia was in a disoriented state, how could this have happened? Well, given that Patricia had been going through a very stressful time in her life, this led her psychologist to theorize that the accident had caused her to develop amnesia and forget who she was. Either she suffered a head injury, or the trauma of the accident and the fear that she might have killed someone in the crash triggered something in her brain and caused her to deliberately block things out. In which case, she was now wandering the country as a transient with no memory of her past life. While no one could ever track Patricia down, the number of reported sightings of her in the years following her disappearance would reach 5,000. In 2011, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police released a composite sketch of an unidentified female victim whose partial skull fragment had been found near a creek in Mission, British Columbia in 1995. DNA testing linked the skull fragment to human remains found on the farm of notorious Canadian serial killer Robert Picton. When the sketch of the victim was shared on the Web Sleuths forum, some posters thought she bore a striking resemblance to Patricia Meehan, and given that she went missing in the Pacific Northwest, they wondered if perhaps she crossed the border into Canada and crossed paths with Picton. A tip was submitted to the RCMP, but it doesn't look like this lead ever went anywhere. Unfortunately, in spite of all the sightings of Patricia, she has still never been tracked down, and her current whereabouts remain unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, if you ask any Unsolved Mysteries fan about the Patricia Meehan segment, the first thing that will pop into their head is her self-portrait, which is one of the most iconic images ever featured on the show, so of course we had to make it the cover photo for this podcast episode. After she went missing, Patricia's family found a roll of undeveloped film in her camera, and after developing the photos, discovered a self-portrait Patricia had taken of herself in a mirror, which I guess would be the 1989 equivalent of a selfie. It's a pretty haunting photograph, and when you look into Patricia's eyes, you can only imagine what's going on in her head. Apparently, she had a similar look in her eyes when she stared at the other motorist after the accident, before she disappeared. But as memorable as this segment is, the reason I couldn't really devote an entire episode to the case is that there really isn't too much to analyze. We know that Patricia got into an accident, wandered off, and disappeared, but the only unanswered question is what happened to her. It's pretty clear that Patricia was suffering from depression and dealing with serious mental health issues at this time. I'm pretty certain she was single then, as some of the articles about her case reference an ex-boyfriend who lived in Spokane, Washington, and became actively involved in the search for her, though I don't know any details about their relationship, or how long they had been broken up by this point. But even though Patricia's psychologist seemed to think the accident triggered her amnesia, something was definitely wrong long before the accident occurred. There has never been any explanation to account for why Patricia was driving on a rural highway nearly 400 miles away from her home, but the fact that she had clothing and other items in her car might seem to indicate that she was attempting the 1,800-mile cross-country trip to see her family in Pittsburgh, or it's possible that she could have lost her memory before she crashed her car and had no idea where she was going. Let's also not forget that Patricia was driving on the wrong side of the road, and you could assume that perhaps Patricia was attempting suicide by deliberately causing a head-on collision. Whatever the case, even though it was never officially confirmed that Patricia suffered a head injury in the accident, something was clearly wrong with her when she wandered out into the prairie. So there are really only two possibilities here. This took place on a very cold night, so either Patricia died of exposure out there on that prairie, and her remains have never been found, or she did manage to get a ride out of the area, and spent the next little while wandering around the country as a transient. I've mentioned numerous times on this podcast that it's very common for people to go missing in remote areas like this, and for the remains to never be found, even after an extensive search effort. You could easily compare this story to my episode about Dawn Kemp, who vanished under similar circumstances onto a Wyoming prairie. Like with Patricia, an extensive ground and air search was conducted of the area, but Dawn's remains were not found until over 3 years later. Now, I know we've had around 5,000 eyewitness sightings of Patricia after she went missing, and that's an awful lot, but once again, I frequently mention on this podcast how common it is for eyewitnesses in missing persons cases to be mistaken and proven wrong. However, in this particular case, I think there's a decent chance that at least some of these sightings might be accurate. When you watch the Unsolved Mysteries segment and read the original news articles about this case, it's interesting how they specifically use the word confirmed to describe some of these sightings. I mean, I'm pretty certain that these witnesses saw a woman who looked a lot like Patricia, but I don't know how they could 100% confirm it was her, unless the witnesses shared some specific details about her which were not released to the public. But it is interesting how there are multiple sightings of a disoriented-looking woman resembling Patricia in different places like Montana, South Dakota, and Minnesota, which sound fairly similar. The sighting at the restaurant in Bozeman is definitely the most credible, since it was Patricia's hometown, and the two waitresses were quite certain the woman they saw was her after viewing a videotape of Patricia, which is quite different than just looking at a photograph, since they can study Patricia's mannerisms and how she talked. If this woman was Patricia, I have to wonder if there was something in the back of her mind which made her think she might be from Bozeman, but the symptoms of her amnesia prevented her from figuring out who she really was. All that being said, remember that false lead where the woman was arrested in Idaho in 1990? Even though it wasn't Patricia, she apparently had a strong resemblance to her, so it's easy to see how all these witnesses, even the ones who were 100% certain, could have seen another woman who looked a lot like Patricia and been mistaken. But overall, while I do think there is just as likely a chance that Patricia never made it off the Montana prairie and died out there, I believe this might be one of those rare missing persons cases where the victim was still alive for some time after they vanished. But sadly, even though I do think it's possible that Patricia might have lived for a little while after the accident, I don't think she ever regained her memories, and it seems unlikely that she is still alive today. It's possible that she has disappeared into the homeless population, and is still living like a transient out there somewhere, but it's difficult to be able to maintain that lifestyle for nearly 30 years, and given the amount of hitchhiking Patricia would have had to do, it's also possible she could have met with foul play. I found that lead about her possibly traveling to British Columbia and becoming a murder victim of Robert Picton to be very intriguing, but I find the odds of that are very minuscule. However, if Patricia is still alive out there somewhere, she would be 66 years old today, so I guess it's not completely impossible. So if you happen to have any information about her whereabouts, please contact the Macon County Sheriff's Office at 406-485-3405. That's 406-485-3405. Anyway, before we move on to our next Unsolved Mystery from Montana, here's a quick word from our sponsors. This episode of The Trail Went Cold is brought to you by Zola, and we are very excited that they are now supporting the show. Zola is reinventing the wedding registry and planning process to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. From engagement to wedding and decorating your first home, Zola has you covered. Zola Registry has everything you love about your favorite department store, as well as things like honeymoon funds, fitness classes, and wine subscriptions. There are over 500 brands and 50,000 gifts and experiences. It's free, fun, and easy to use for both couples and their guests. They have price matching, free shipping, personalization options, and group gifting. Zola also has a free suite of wedding planning tools, including a free wedding website where guests can seamlessly shop and get details on the registry in one convenient place. Zola's friendly customer service team will go above and beyond, whether that's helping pick out the perfect blender or walking a grandmother through a couple's registry. There's also tools for the host such as a customizable checklist and guest list manager. Join 300,000 couples who have used Zola. I gotta tell you, I've known my fair share of people who have gotten majorly stressed out at planning their wedding or engagement party, but if they had Zola at their disposal at that time, the experience definitely would have been less stressful and more enjoyable. And from my personal experience, even trying to pick out the perfect engagement or wedding gift can be stressful, but I found Zola's website to have an amazing selection of gifts, and it's so convenient and easy to navigate. So to sign up with Zola and receive a $50 credit towards your registry, visit zola.com/cold and use the promo code COLD at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. That's a $50 credit towards your registry by visiting zola.com/cold and using the promo code COLD at checkout. This episode of The Trail Went Cold is also brought to you by Aptiv, another sponsor whom we are very excited to have supporting the show. Aptiv produces audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers available through a mobile app. Aptiv makes the highest quality training available to everyone with a carefully selected group of certified personal trainers that guide you through every workout. The trainers have a wide array of personalities, so you can even find the personal training styling that motivates you best. Plus, Aptiv's in-house music production team partners with every trainer to create music playlists that are perfectly timed to the intensity and pace of your workout. When you need that extra boost, the music keeps you going and motivated. When you're ready to slow things down, the intensity of the music dials down with you. Whenever or wherever you like to work out, at the gym, at home, outside, when you're traveling for business, Aptiv is ready to go along with you with their mobile app. It's like having a personal trainer in your pocket. Whether you're interested in running, strength training, indoor cycling, stair climbing, yoga, or even meditation, Aptiv trainers give you the guidance you need to be better at the types of exercises you love, delivered in a flexible audio format to make fitness a lasting part of your routine. Aptiv has classes for all fitness levels, from beginner to intermediate to advanced. And with more than 2,500 workouts available on the platform and over 30 new classes added each week, there's always a new workout to try. Or simply pick the type of guidance you are feeling up for that day, whether it's technical training, high-energy coaching, or bootcamp-style intensity. One of the best features of Aptiv is the ability to search by difficulty, music genre, and duration, so you can find a workout you love every time. As you might have guessed, being a podcaster is not a job which lends itself to a lot of physical activity, as you spend the majority of your time plopped down in front of a computer or a microphone. So in order to keep myself in good shape, I was very grateful to receive a free trial with Aptiv. Instead of having to take the time to travel to a gym somewhere, it was very convenient to work out with Aptiv's mobile app, which provides a flexible audio workout format that allows me to work out just the way I like without even having to leave my own home. That certainly saves me a lot of much-needed time. Subscriptions start at $9.99 billed monthly or $99.99 for an annual membership. For a limited time, new members get 50% off an annual membership, which is just $49.99 for the whole year of unlimited workouts. So to take advantage of this offer, visit aptiv.com/cold. That's aaptiv.com/cold. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of our episode. Our second story begins in Great Falls, Montana in 1985. Our central figure is 23-year-old Morris Davis Jr., who works as a delivery man at a local pizza parlor. At 8:34 p.m. on the evening of April 5th, they received an order for a pizza delivery to a residential house on the northwest side of Great Falls. After the pizza was made, it was handed over to Morris for delivery, and he left at around 9:15. After an hour and a half passed by, Morris had still not returned, so another driver was sent out to look for him and went to the address of Morris's last delivery. When he entered the house, he was shocked to find Morris's body near the front door. He had been shot 9 times with a .22 caliber weapon. The police were called, and in a cruel twist of fate, one of the paramedics who arrived at the scene was Morris's younger brother, Cliff Davis, who entered the house and let out a scream when he saw Morris's body on the floor. Cliff accompanied his brother in the ambulance to the hospital, but Morris was pronounced dead on arrival. On the surface, it appeared that robbery was the motive. Morris's delivery wallet, which contained just under $300, was missing, though strangely, Morris's own personal wallet was left behind. But whoever committed the crime had orchestrated a very elaborate scheme. It turned out the house Morris delivered to was vacant, and the killer went to the trouble of removing a for sale sign from the front lawn. Since the house did not have phone service, the killer went to a nearby payphone to place the order for the pizza before breaking into the house through the back door. He then waited for Morris to arrive, shot him after he entered the house, and then fled with his delivery wallet. Morris was filling in for another driver who had originally been scheduled to work that night, and since the pizza parlor employed several drivers, the killer could not have known with 100% certainty that Morris would personally deliver to him. By all accounts, Morris was a very well-liked guy with no known enemies, so it seemed like he was not deliberately targeted and was just the victim of a completely random crime. The investigation failed to uncover a solid suspect and remained at a total standstill for 3 years before a very strange series of events occurred. On May 11, 1988, a man was pulled over and arrested for driving a stolen vehicle, which he had taken from a friend in Oregon. In addition, the suspect had also stolen a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol from his friend, and a receipt for it was found in his pocket for a pawn shop in Great Falls, which was located 180 miles from where he was arrested. The Great Falls police recovered the gun from the pawn shop, but then remembered how Morris Davis had been shot to death with a .22 caliber weapon. So on a whim, they decided to send the gun to the ballistics lab for testing. To their astonishment, there turned out to be a complete match to the bullets from the crime scene, and the stolen gun was determined to be the same murder weapon which killed Morris. The suspect who had stolen the vehicle and the gun was investigated and cleared of any involvement in Morris's murder, so the focus now turned towards the gun's original owner in Oregon, who had purchased the weapon prior to April of 1985. And this is where things get confusing. The guy from Oregon denied any involvement or knowledge of the crime, and claimed at the time the murder took place, he had a newborn son, so he was keeping the .22 caliber pistol safely stowed away in a hall closet between some blankets. The problem is that nobody else besides this guy and his wife knew the gun was kept there, and he did not recall it ever going missing during this time period. The man was thoroughly investigated by police, who determined that he had a rock-solid alibi at the time of Morris's murder. So on the surface, it seemed like someone else had stolen the gun from this guy's closet, traveled to Great Falls to shoot Morris, and then returned to Oregon to place the gun back in the closet without anybody noticing. This development baffled the hell out of everyone for years, but it turned out there was a logical, or illogical, explanation for the whole thing. They simply screwed up the ballistic tests. In 1995, some new ballistic tests were performed, and guess what? It turned out the gun from Oregon was not actually the murder weapon used to shoot Morris Davis. So unfortunately, this whole series of events turned out to be one of the strangest red herrings in history. The investigation went right back to square one, and over 30 years later, no one has ever been charged in the murder of Morris Davis. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Well, needless to say, I'm always really bothered by these completely random and senseless crimes where an innocent person is murdered for something as small as a couple $100. And because of the randomness of these crimes, it's often very difficult to figure out who was responsible. In this particular case, I have a feeling that the perpetrator just wanted to kill someone and didn't care who it was. If robbery was the primary motive, I think there would have been simpler ways to go about it. And if this person had simply pointed a gun at Morris and told him to hand over the money, he probably would have complied without any resistance. The fact that the gunman would commit major overkill by shooting Morris 8 times and didn't even bother taking his personal wallet makes me think that he was more interested in a thrill kill than a simple robbery. Since the perpetrator couldn't have been certain that Morris would make the delivery, this was probably not a personal killing, and Morris was just a victim who was at the wrong place at the wrong time. But sadly, in the days before caller ID, it actually wasn't uncommon for people to place phony orders like this to lure delivery people to places where they could rob or harm them. Here's a disturbing turn of events you might not be aware of. On December 13, 1990, Travis Robeson, a 21-year-old delivery driver at a Domino's Pizza in Billings, Montana, was shot to death while attempting to deliver a pizza to an address which turned out to be an abandoned house. This time, the killer wound up with only $13.40 from Travis's delivery wallet, and they also took the pizza. What's particularly creepy is that the Unsolved Mysteries segment about Morris Davis aired only 1 week earlier on December 5th, so given the similarity between the two crimes and the fact that they took place in Montana, one couldn't help but wonder if this was either a copycat crime or if the show might have inspired Morris's killer to strike again. Well, only 1 week after the crime, two suspects, 20-year-old Billy Lamond and 18-year-old Randall Lionshows, were arrested for Travis's murder, and they eventually pled guilty and received lengthy prison sentences. They were never connected to Morris Davis's murder, and it's highly unlikely they were involved, given they still would have been kids at the time, but it is creepy to think they might have gotten the idea for their crime from watching Unsolved Mysteries. Anyway, with so little evidence to work with, I think the primary reason this case got featured on Unsolved Mysteries was because of the weird turn of events involving the .22 caliber pistol stolen from Oregon. The first time I ever watched this segment, I was left completely baffled by this and just could not figure out how that gun could have been used in the crime. But then when I learned this was all due to the fact that they botched the original ballistic tests, I felt like banging my head against the wall. I mean, my God, how much time and resources were wasted investigating this false lead? One person I really felt bad for was the gun's original owner in Oregon. When he was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, he was shot in silhouette with his voice digitally altered in order to conceal his identity, and really, who could blame him? It must be pretty terrifying to learn that a gun you owned was used to kill someone in an entirely different state, and you can offer no explanation for how this happened. Thankfully, this guy wasn't railroaded and falsely implicated in a murder he had nothing to do with, but man, how frustrating must it have been for Morris's family to find out years later that this lead was a giant red herring and the investigation had reached a dead end again. However, all that being said, the investigation did eventually uncover someone who seems like a fairly solid suspect. On October 6, 1986, 18-year-old Suzette Pritchard was working an overnight shift alone at a Great Falls convenience store when she was murdered by someone who came in and robbed the store of $300 and stabbed Suzette 24 times. The case went unsolved for 11 years before police received information from a prison informant about a suspect named Donald Dubray. Dubray had an extensive criminal history and was serving a 27-year sentence for rape in Montana State Prison, where he had apparently bragged about Suzette Pritchard's murder. After an extensive investigation uncovered evidence to implicate Dubray in the crime, he was charged and convicted of robbery, felony theft, and murder. He received a life sentence for the murder, plus an additional 20 years for robbery and 10 years for felony theft. And on top of that, a state district judge ordered that $5,150 be garnished from Dubray's prison wages in order to pay restitution to the Pritchard family for Suzette's funeral. In May of 2016, Dubray was found dead in his cell at the age of 55. Well, John Cameron, the police detective who solved the Pritchard case, always suspected that Dubray might have also been responsible for Morris Davis' murder, since it took place in Great Falls only a year earlier, and it was another crime in which someone was brutally murdered over a robbery of only a couple $100. Traffic tickets placed Dubray in Great Falls before and after Morris' murder, and during this time period, he had also committed a robbery in the town of Browning, and shot another victim with a .22 caliber weapon. For years, Cameron corresponded with DeBray in prison and hoped he might get him to confess to Morris's murder, but it never happened. However, that's not all. In 2013, Morris's brother, Cliff Davis, actually posted a couple of times on the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the sitcom's online forum. He claimed that he also corresponded with DeBray in prison, and that DeBray provided very specific details about Morris's murder and the house where it took place. At one point, DeBray apparently told Cliff he was present at the house that night, but was not the shooter. But in spite of this, DeBray never did take responsibility for the crime, and no evidence ever linked him to it. Now, I have to concede that I've read some articles about Detective John Cameron, and he has faced criticism in the past because he had a tendency to focus too much on certain suspects in the cases he investigated and neglect other potential leads. It sounds like some of the other investigators were skeptical about his belief that DeBray was Morris's killer, but if what Cliff posted was true, he certainly is a compelling suspect. Cameron's instinct was right when he linked DeBray to the Suzette Pritchard murder, and I do see parallels between the two cases. Suzette was murdered over the theft of $300, and DeBray stabbed this 18-year-old girl 24 times, which is major overkill to say the least, much like shooting Morris 8 times to rob him. It sounds like Suzette's murder was something of a thrill kill, and robbery was the secondary motive, and you could also say the same thing about what happened to Morris. I do know there isn't any direct evidence here, but my gut tells me that DeBray was the guy who killed Morris. If he was, then it's sad that DeBray went on to murder someone else, but he did finally get locked up and spent the last chunk of his life in prison, so justice was ultimately served for him. I guess the problem is that DeBray is now deceased, so if he was responsible for Morris's murder, we may never know for sure. But until we do know, this case will officially remain open. So if you have any information on the unsolved murder of Morris Davis, please contact the Great Falls Police Department at 406-727-7688. That's 406-727-7688. So that concludes our double feature episode on Unsolved Mysteries from Montana. If you have your own thoughts about either of these cases, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Anyway, I just wanted to give one more shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide my thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. We also have a Facebook discussion group, so if you feel like discussing the podcast or the cases we feature with myself and your fellow listeners, feel free to join and I'll approve your entry into the group ASAP. Like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, so if you want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put in this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. Anyway, since this is our final episode of the year, I can only close things off by thanking each and every one of you listeners for making 2017 such an amazing year for The Trail Went Cold. As we approach our official 2-year anniversary in February, this podcast continues to grow and has become much bigger than I could have anticipated, so we are so grateful for your support. There were many highlights in 2017, and one of them was getting to attend CrimeCon in Indianapolis this past June. Not only did I get to meet and become friends with many of my fellow true crime podcasters, some of whom were huge inspirations for The Trail Went Cold, but it was so humbling to finally get to meet and hang out with some of you folks and hear you express how much you loved our show, and you even went so far as to ask me for selfies sometimes. I am now officially booked to be on Podcast Row at CrimeCon this coming year in Nashville from May 4th to the 6th, and I hope I get the opportunity to meet many more of you folks. So once again, a big thank you for all of your support, and I can assure you that 2018 is going to be an even bigger year for the podcast. So join me next week, no, make that next year, for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶